Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Taking it to the streets, election rallies bring out tens of thousands in Iran. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. In Tehran this week, supporters of a reform candidate lined up in a 12-mile human chain across the city, while supporters of incumbent candidate Mahmoud Ahmadinejad have taken to the streets waving his photo. Text messages, Facebook, and TV debates are all part of the fray. Will this new spirit of debate continue after the election? Would a new president take a different tack in dealing with the West? Also tonight, California's running out of money. Will the government shut down if a budget isn't reached? First, here's the news. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. We're back with Which Way LA on KCRW. In Iran, the past 3 weeks have seen an election campaign that's been surprisingly hard-fought. Incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad faces a strong challenge from reformist Mir Hussein Mousavi, who's broken with convention by campaigning with his outspoken wife at his side. Will urban women and youth tip the scales towards a Mousavi win? Or will hardliners and the rural poor help Ahmadinejad win re-election? How will the outcome of the election affect politics in the region and relationships with the West? Also tonight, Governor Schwarzenegger threatens to let the state government's lights go out if a budget deal isn't reached in the next few weeks. First, this story. President Obama continues his drive to rein in rising health care costs. Today, he hosted a town hall meeting in Green Bay, Wisconsin, a city that may be a model for effective and efficient health care. Here's part of what he said today.
We have to ask why places like Gessinger Health Systems in rural Pennsylvania, or Intermountain Health in Salt Lake City, or communities like Green Bay can offer high-quality care at costs well below average, but other places in America can't. We need to identify the best practices across the country, learn from the successes, and then duplicate those successes everywhere else.
My guest is Chris Freites. He's a reporter for Politico and author of Politico's daily newsletter, The Pulse. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Sarah. It's good to be with you.
So what's the message behind the message today as the president takes his health care plan or speeches to Green Bay, Wisconsin?
The message behind the message is, look, I'm surrounded by thousands of people who are cheering my points and want to get health care reform done. Take a look, Congress. I am building support for it. I'm going to use my grassroots organization that got me elected to help push this. And you need to take heed that I will not accept any kind of delay or any kind of non-action on this issue. So he's out there. He's starting to push. He's going to give the air cover to the troops on the ground, and that's his Democratic colleagues in the Congress.
And are they feeling it, do you think? Are they getting the message?
Well, absolutely. I mean, before he left, he called in four key senators, both Democrats and Republicans, to the White House yesterday to drive that point home personally. This is not a surprise to people on the Hill, and the question will become, and the thing that Obama needs to avoid, is a protracted fight on this. This is a huge issue. Republicans are already trying to slow walk it by saying we need to take our time. This is a huge overhaul. Why the rush? But Obama and Democrats understand that his political capital will never be bigger than it is right now. And to tackle something this big, this huge, with so many entrenched interests, a $2.5 trillion a year industry, is going to take some serious pushing.
Why Green Bay, Wisconsin?
Green Bay, Wisconsin was chosen. One, it's in the heartland. Two, it also has done a good job in controlling their own costs. The Washington Post had a good story today about exactly how they have tried to take and make that balance. And Obama's been pushing a cost control message along with coverage. Part of what Democrats have realized, particularly after the Massachusetts reforms that happened a few years ago, that if you just offer coverage and you don't do something to work on controlling the cost, you end up spending way too much money on the coverage without being able to rein it in. So there's a dual message here, and Green Bay, which has been successful in controlling costs and providing coverage was a real good platform for the president to talk about that.
And today he made a point of calling for a public insurance option. Is that one of the toughest points he has to sell?
Absolutely. It's been one of the flashpoints from the get-go that the supporters of a public option have been pounding the drum on this for more than a year. You know, it's important for your readers or your listeners to understand that this is not something that has just started happening now. The groundwork for this reform effort was started to be laid 2 years ago. And what we're seeing now is a very sophisticated campaign by Democrats and supporters of a public plan who believe that if you create a plan that competes with private insurance companies, you'll keep those companies honest, that they won't be able to jack rates, that they'll have to provide good quality coverage because people could go elsewhere. Republicans often believe that this will create a backdoor to government run health care. Why would anybody join a private plan if they could get a public plan that might be subsidized by the government, which creates an uneven playing field? Why would they join a private insurance company if they could just join the public plan? They fear that everybody will end up in a public plan. It will destroy private insurance as we know it in this country. And it's a question about, as a society, how do we want to offer our health insurance?
What about this coming Monday? The president's going to be addressing the American Medical Association. Will he be changing the tone of his speech, making different points?
I don't think so. And what's so interesting about this, Sarah, is that the American Medical Association has just come out and said, we oppose a public plan. And doctors from other groups are emailing me furiously saying the AMA does not speak for all doctors. They only speak for specialists. But this idea that a doctor's group is against the public plan and he's going to walk into that group on Monday to mm-hmm. explain where he's coming from, I think he takes the opportunity to walk into the lion's den and say, but this is why I believe in it. And this is what I'm going to try to talk about, the need for health reform.
Thanks for joining us. Chris Freitz is a reporter for Politico and author of Politico's daily newsletter, The Pulse. We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
I'm Sarah Terry, back with Which Way LA. Tomorrow, voters in Iran head to the polls in what has become an almost free-for-all presidential election. Incumbent Mahmoud Ahmadinejad faces a strong challenge from reformist candidate Mirhossein Mousavi. Iranians have been out on the streets in the tens of thousands, with a fervor that many say hasn't been seen since the toppling of the Shah 30 years ago. What are the issues driving voters? What role will women play in the outcome of the vote? What changes may come in Iran's relations with the West? My first guest is Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's joining us from his home in Tehran. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You wrote in today's paper, I think it was, that these have been strange, magical days in Iran. Can you tell us about it?
I mean, it's just been an extraordinary explosion of political activity and festivities out on the streets. People out basically having tailgate parties, essentially, and flooding the streets until 3, 4 in the morning, playing music very loud, chanting, holding up props and drums. And this is primarily driven by the candidacy of one particular candidate, Mirhossein Mousavi, who has managed to tap into a popular well of anger, really, and resentment that has been the kind of surprise factor of this election.
I think one of the surprising things is getting these reports, at least here in the United States, hearing most recently that women were dancing in the streets with men, that some of them had thrown off headscarves, which, of course, they're legally required to wear there. It's a short campaign season, 3 weeks. What was the tipping point here that led to this much public expression of will and debate?
You know, I'm not exactly sure, I think we're still sort of assessing what happened here. But, I mean, there's a few things that we're getting to recognize. One is that, as we reported Sunday and the New York Times followed suit today, there are very powerful figures inside the Iranian establishment that want Ahmadinejad out, and they're giving a lot of logistical support to the Mossadegh campaign.
And who are the people who want him out? Who are those powerful figures?
Leadership. I think there's two or three constituencies that want him out. In the leadership, the people who want him out there's two varieties. One are the what you would call the traditional conservatives. Many of them clerics who were the original pillars of the Islamic Revolution, especially Ayatollah Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who is Iran's premier power broker. And then there's another constituency, which is just the a broad, growing mass of educated, fairly educated, middle-class Iranians who have ties to the outside world, are not in agreement with the kind of hardline Islamic ideology of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And for them, this election is nothing more than a referendum on Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And when they go cast their votes tomorrow and wait in those lines, they see their vote as a vote against him, not necessarily for Mir Hossein Mousavi.
And I'm curious, you're describing two forces there, the clerics, who have been the notoriously conservative backbone of the regime, and this more educated middle class. In this open space that's been created in these 3 weeks, where people are so free in expression, some have even called Ahmadinejad a liar publicly, things that, of course, wouldn't have been tolerated before. These are things that the clerics would not be supporting, but yet they're allowing it. In this, I'm going based on what you've said, it's being allowed to perhaps reach a political end they want, but will they permit this kind of openness afterwards?
I think that's a big question. I think that's the question, is what happens after this? What does this turn into? But I think that something has cracked. And ironically, it was Ahmadinejad himself who started it beginning to just start attacking those traditional conservatives publicly on television and accusing them of corruption. These are pillars of the revolution. These were Khomeini's deputies, and he's saying that these guys are crooked and corrupt and a bunch of big mafia bosses. Who are these people? And that created a kind of cycle of resentment within the establishment that further cracked open the space. So people started accusing Ahmadinejad openly in live television debates of being a liar. These are huge people in the Islamic Republic, not just people on the streets. And so that kind of exposed the whole game, so to speak, that these guys have been fighting, that they're, you know, wheeling and dealing between each other the whole, you know, 30 years. And that's going to be hard. That's going to be a harder genie to put back into the bottle than the people out on the streets having fun.
Borzu Dargah, he writes for the Los Angeles Times. He's joining us now from his home in Tehran. Warren Strobel is senior correspondent for foreign affairs for the McClatchy newspapers. He's also joining us from Tehran. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We've just been talking with Borzu about some of the internal dynamics that are at play in this sort of free-for-all of expression and debate that's been going on in Iran, which seems unprecedented in recent years, at least. How much does what's going on have to do, is it purely internal dynamics, or are there external factors? Does a change in presidential administrations in the United States have anything to do with what's happening in internal politics?
You know, Sarah, I think this is primarily an election about Iran. The issues you hear over and over are economic ones. The economy here is in serious trouble for a variety of reasons. And as Borzu said, this is also, more than anything, this election is a referendum on Ahmadinejad. Having said that, there are a lot of Iranians I talk to of various stripes who are really embarrassed. They see Ahmadinejad as an embarrassment. They disagree with the things he said about the Holocaust. They're eager for at least an attempt at repairing relations with the United States. So in that sense, international affairs, relations with the U.S. are a little bit of an issue here. People are aware of what Obama has said. It's not a determining factor, but it's an important factor. And one other thing, I think, you know, if Mousavi is elected, or one of the other reformer, Mr. Karoubi, is elected, they have some power, but the real power to deal with international relations, security issue, the nuclear issue, lies with the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei.
Well, perhaps you can help us sort of look perhaps beneath the surface a bit. The forces that led to Ahmadinejad's election in the first place that may now seem to be working against his re-election. What's changing internally in Iran in terms of theme? Is it simply, as we heard from Borzou, that he's attacked sort of the pillars of the revolution? Or is there more going on? Is there a desire for a shift in focus, in tone from Iran?
Ahmadinejad has made an awful lot of enemies, as Borzou said, with some of the most powerful pillars of this country. And just the feeling of the youth out in the streets is incredible. I've heard people call this a milestone, historic, in terms of the street demonstrations. Rallies is a better term. And they're expressing a desire for change. And I don't want to overestimate or exaggerate things here, but there's a little bit of an undercurrent of tension, too. I was sitting in my hotel room last night writing, very late at night, listening to the very loud honking of horns and screaming from the Mousavi supporters, when over the news wire came a little news break where the commander of the Revolutionary Guard said on their website that Mousavi supporters are inciting a velvet revolution. There's a little bit of a question in my mind. Again, I don't want to exaggerate it, but if Mousavi is not elected and there's a feeling that he was cheated out of the election, whether there's going to be not wide-scale riots and revolution, but some protests at the least.
Well, we should also point out he's had thousands of protesters out in the streets supporting him, people who've said he's courageous, he stands up to the West, he's popular with the rural poor. I mean, who are the forces that are working for him?
His support, as I understand it, is, as you say, the rural poor, the working class, the security forces, very much so, the Revolutionary Guard, the police, the military. And a lot of average Iranians who see him as a sort of the model or epitome of Iranian nationalism, Iranian pride, willing to stand up to the West. And the one thing that must be said for Ahmadinejad, as far as I know, and maybe Borzou would correct me, he's not personally corrupt, which is something fairly unusual in Iranian politics.
And if Mousavi were to win, what kinds of changes would you expect to see internally in Iran and in relations with the West?
It's a really good question. I'm writing a story tonight where I call Mousavi a little bit of a cipher, because you have all these people who are so unhappy with the situation that they're sort of broadcasting or projecting their desires upon him. What he would actually do is a little bit of a question. I think he would move to try to slowly, cautiously restore relations with the United States with the approval or guidance of the Supreme Leader. And internally, I think he's going to try to loosen up an economy that is in trouble for so many reasons and is dominated by the government. There's very little private sector here. I think the term reformist is a little strong, frankly. The real reformist in this race is Mehdi Karoubi, who is much to the left of Mousavi. Mousavi is better described as a moderate or moderate conservative.
Okay. And if Mousavi or the more reformist candidate you've mentioned were to win or to show great strengths in the elections on Friday, closer to home, what would that mean for Iranian relations with Israel, which has been so offended by Ahmadinejad's claims about the Holocaust, his stance towards Israel in general?
Good question. I think, it's possible that it might stave off any idea, any thought that the Israeli government might have of a preemptive attack on Iran's suspected nuclear weapons program. But more broadly, any rapprochements or relations between Israel and Iran are so far off, it's hard to kind of even see it at this point, even if one of these alternate candidates would be elected. And we should add one more point just real quickly for your listeners, Sarah. No presidential candidate incumbent has been defeated since the Iranian revolution in 1979. So if Ahmadinejad were to lose, it would be a huge, huge thing, both internally and externally.
Warren Strobel is senior correspondent for foreign affairs from McClatchy Newspapers. He's joining us from Tehran. My next guest is Miriam Memarsadaghi. She's a Washington-based advisor to NGOs promoting democracy and human rights in the Middle East. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What we haven't talked about yet with Warren Strobel and Borzou Daragahi is the role of women in this election and
yes.
the presence of a very strong woman, wife, the Mousavi's wife. They've even been holding hands on their campaign platform. And what's happening on the women's front?
Well, on the women's front, there has been a robust campaign for 1 million signatures that existed, has existed in the last few years, really throughout the Ahmadinejad presidency, calling for women's legal equality. The women behind this campaign have used the presidential elections as a platform to press for their demands, calling on all the candidates to respond to their demands for changing the constitution and Iran's laws to guarantee gender equality and to get Iran to sign on to the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. So they've made these two demands their primary focus. And yes, in the personality of Zahra Rahnavard, many women, many youth have seen a sort of an inspiring change, particularly when compared to sort of the marriage dynamic that Ahmadinejad and his sort of traditional class have. She's quite different and projects herself as a very different kind of wife and very much active on the campaign trail alongside her husband.
You've noted the women wanting to have equality enshrined. One of the reports I was listening to mentioned that in the past, men have spoken a lot about the equity of women, that they're cherished and valued in Iranian culture, but that this conversation marks a major shift towards actually saying equality of women.
Well, yes, very important point. Before the revolution, Iran had some of the most liberal and forward-looking laws on the family and women's rights, particularly in the region. The revolution brought in a serious regression and an undoing of the advances that women had made. Women judges were disbarred. Many were killed and executed. Their bodies were dragged out onto the street. Women, for all practical purposes, were barred from employment for many years. The Nobel Prize winner Shirin Ebadi, for example, went from being a judge to sitting at home for several years and because the only position she was offered was as a secretary. Now what's happened is, you know, after 30 years talking about, you know, having the courage to say, we don't want equity. We don't want to talk about women's proper role in an Islamic household. We want full equality.
We're talking to Maryam Memarsadeghi, a Washington-based advisor to NGOs promoting democracy and human rights in the Middle East. Let's go back to Warren Strobel of the McClatchy newspapers. As we look forward to the election, what will be the most important message? What should we be watching for?
Two things. First of all, what we've talked about on the show already, which is the incredible enthusiasm, fervent of the students, the desire for change, the sense that, as Borzu said, something is cracked. And what happens afterwards, after the election. Secondly, just in terms of tomorrow, I'm going to look at turnout. I was talking today to a businessman who's not a politician by any means, a very savvy guy. He pointed out that the conservatives are sort of like the Republicans in the United States. They have a base turnout, base vote, which here is about 15 million people. And the reformists or moderates, more like the Democrats, their turnout is up and down depending on the candidate in the election. And if the reformists can get a good turnout tomorrow, they seem to have at least a reasonable shot of unseating Ahmadinejad.
Is there any way that the vote could be rigged?
Yes. There is. There's concerns about vote rigging. The view here is that if it's a close vote, that there might be some rigging enough to put Ahmadinejad over the top. But if he's losing in a blowout, the powers that be, including the Supreme Leader and the other people who really run Iran, will not want to go against public opinion enough to rig the vote that much.
And if there is a change in presidency as a result of this election, how much time do you think the regime will spend, the spiritual leaders behind the offices? How long will it take them to recalibrate, remoderate, or come out with the message that they want Iran to be?
Good question. If Ahmadinejad loses, there's going to be a heck of a lot of turmoil and confusion, controversy here. I would think it would be well into the fall, September, October, which means it could be, again, into the fall before we have a sense of whether there's a chance for constructive dialogue between Iran and, and the United States.
Thanks to Warren Strobel. He's senior correspondent for foreign affairs from McClatchy Newspapers. He's covering the elections in Iran, joined us from Tehran. My next guest is Mohsen Mehlani. He's professor and chair of the Department of Government and International Affairs at the University of South Florida. He's also the author of The Making of Iran's Islamic Revolution, From Monarchy to Islamic Republic, and also a forthcoming piece in Foreign Affairs on Iran's policy towards the United States. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you step back a bit from this conversation we're having about these remarkable elections in Iran and give us a bigger picture here? What trending historically we're seeing and what it might mean in terms of Iranian foreign policy?
Well, let me start with the second part of the question, which
okay.
is the changes that we can expect as a result of this election in terms of Iran's nuclear policy or its foreign policy. The political structure in Iran is such that the supreme leader makes the ultimate decision regarding Iran's security and nuclear policies. Having said that, it does not mean that he can single-handedly determine what that policy or that strategy should be. There is a Supreme National Security Council, which consists of a number of powerful figures, including Iranian president, the representatives of the supreme leader, and a number of other key figures, chiefs of intelligence agencies and the regular army and the Pasdaran. They are the ones who decide. They are the ones who determine what the policy should be. Then they send it to the supreme leader, who can either veto it or accept it. Therefore, the outcome of the election can have a significant influence in how the Supreme National Security Council decides to deal with Iran's nuclear and foreign policy. Now, if you pay close attention to the three debates that took place in Iran, which was truly unique, both in terms of history of Iranian presidential elections since 1979, and also in the Middle East, short of outside of Israel and perhaps Turkey, at least I've never seen that kind of serious debate amongst contenders for power. In those debates, none of the candidates discussed the issue of Iran's nuclear policies. And the reason why they didn't is because they know this is a sensitive issue and it's the kind of issue that requires consensus among multiple centers of power in Iranians' highly factionalized political system. Therefore, if Ahmadinejad loses, and that, I think, depends entirely on the voter turnout, if the voter turnout is above 65% to 70%, as was the case in 1998 when Khatami won, even if the conservatives and Ahmadinejad tries to rig the election, most likely they won't be able to do so, and Mousavi will win. But if Mousavi wins, then we are going to see some major changes in the orientation of Iranian foreign policy. But when it comes to the nuclear issue, that ultimately depends on the supreme leader. And domestically, I think this election is also profoundly important. The economy is in the shambles in Iran. People are unhappy. And the key element to understanding the enthusiasm that you see, and I think that's one of the questions you asked the other participants in the program, the enthusiasm you see in Iran partly has to do with the demography in Iran. Demography is destiny. A significant portion of the Iranian population is young, a significant portion of the population is educated, and they are sick and tired of the way Ahmadinejad and his administration have defamed Iran, have undermined the Iranian economy, and they have decided to take their destiny at their own hands.
Oh,
and that is why you see that kind of incredible enthusiasm amongst youth and amongst educated Iranians today.
And right there, you've brought us to that sort of point that seems to be such a balancing act right now. You've referred to the supreme leader, his role in making final decisions and policies. And this is a conservative, clerical council that we're talking about that has, in some way, unleashed or created the space or allowed the space to happen for this incredible outpouring of democratic sentiment among young people, among women, calling for equality. So what happens After this, is the clerical council going to become less conservative? Are they going to let women, for example, have a greater role in public life? Are they going to regulate them less closely in terms of conservative dress and codes?
Well, let me start with your observation about the kind of enthusiasm and the open space that we see in Iran today. I'm not surprised. What you see in Iran today took place in Iran in 1997. This is the year that President Khatami won the presidential election. More than 79% of the eligible voters participated in the Iranian election of 1997. This is huge. 79% of the people voted in that election, and you see the same kind of enthusiasm today. Therefore, to say that this is unique, I think, would be not entirely accurate.
Okay.
It has happened in 1997, and now we are seeing sort of the second phase of that genuinely democratic movement.
Well, that still brings us to that important point, though, of how long this window remains open in Iran.
Well, I think that is one of my major worries, because one of the major differences between this election and the previous nine presidential elections is that the competing factions have now become extremely polarized, and it is not very clear to me what they're going to do if one of them loses. For example, we know Ahmadinejad is determined to win this election. Now, if he wins, what is going to happen to Ayatollah Hashemi Rafsanjani, who has supported Mousavi and who has been defamed by Ahmadinejad? What is going to happen to him, to his supporters, and to Mousavi and others?
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly do not know what happens after this. What I do know is that Ayatollah Khamenei now has tried to begin the reconciliation. A very important development seems to have taken place in the past few hours, and that is because of the letter that Hashemi Rafsanjani wrote to the Supreme Leader. And remember now, Rafsanjani was the man who was closest to Ayatollah Khomeini. He was one of the major figures of the Islamic revolution. He does not have a great deal of popular support, but within the Islamic system of governance, he is probably one of the most influential people. He wrote a letter to Ayatollah Khamenei and bitterly complained about the way he was treated. And he also complained to him that what has started by Ahmadinejad can in fact undermine the entire system, the entire Islamic Republic. In response to that complaint, we now have heard, and I cannot confirm this, but I've heard it from some friends, and I've seen it in media, that Ayatollah Khamenei has decided to appoint Mr. Natiq-e-Nuri, as a supervisor, as the supervisor to the upcoming elections.
And
that means that he's trying to cover all the bases in case Mousavi wins or in case Ahmadinejad wins. He wants to make sure that he can maintain the balance after the election. I think it is a major move, and I think it is probably, if I be forced to say it, I think it's good news for Mousavi and his campaign.
Okay. Mohsen Milani is professor and chair of the Department of Government and International Affairs at the University of South Florida. Marian Memasardeghi is a Washington-based advisor to NGOs promoting democracy and human rights in the Middle East. Earlier in the show, we were speaking with you about what this election means for women. And I'm curious, from the conversations you're having, do women feel they've really started a new frontier here in Iran, or do they feel precarious in whatever gains they may be making?
Well, I think Professor Milani is very right to point out that this is an experiment or an aspiration that has been tried before. And so there is quite a lot of anxiety around those who are most interested in pressing for civil liberties. The women's rights activists, the student activists, the those pressing for greater freedom of expression, the bloggers, this community that's most exposed and most vulnerable has very strong memories of what happened after Khatami won and began a very short-lived period of civil liberties and press freedom, relative press freedom. The backlash that came, the very, very harsh sentences, the violence against student activists, the many activists who are still in prison today from that time, Iran's Tiananmen Square, if you will, are very much alive in the minds and in the memory of the activists and the average citizens who are pressing for a wholesale change, in my view. The subtext to what's going on here with the backing to Mousavi is not so much, in my view, support for Mousavi the person. It's for wholesale change towards a democratic way of life and open society. And unlike before, when Iranian youth and women in particular, the mass majority of the population, really, it was remarkable, were behind one person, Khatami, this time they're behind their own demands and are much less willing to trust any candidate and really have been the driving factor behind the discourse of Mousavi. They have forced Mousavi to put forth a platform that respects women's rights and respects internet freedom and respects a more merit-based economy that recognizes that Iran is a country of educated people who can't get jobs. This is all sort of with an anxious hopefulness that what happened under the Khatami era doesn't happen again.
That's a fascinating distinction between those two elections. And in hearing you describe essentially a civil society that is bringing its platform to bear on a candidate as opposed to just supporting a candidate, I'm curious, will the women, the youth, the civil society people who have been creating and pushing for these platforms, will they be able to flourish after the election?
That's the key question. You know, that is the key question. The way there are some reasons to think that this time will be different. Among those is the role of the internet. Iran today is a very wired country, and it wasn't so under Khatami. Facebook really got going in this election campaign period. It was banned for a few days. There was such an outcry that the regime, allowed access again. So there's a bit of a genie's out of the bottle dynamic with regard to internet freedom. Iran is, by the way, after China, the worst violator of internet freedom in the world. And yet it also has among the most active internet users in the world. You know, there are hundreds, over 100,000 bloggers. There's a tremendous media available to Iranians who are able to circumvent government filtering. And so this is a massive change, alongside the fact, as I said before, that civil society, women's rights activists, student activists are putting forth clear demands and saying, hey, candidates, anyone who wants our vote, you need to respond to what we think and what we demand rather than the other way around.
Okay, Maryam Memarsadeghi is a Washington-based advisor to NGOs promoting democracy and human rights in the Middle East. Borzu Deragahi, we were talking with you earlier in the conversation, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, joining us from Tehran. Can you sort of wrap up the conversation for us? I'm curious how you, as a reporter and somebody who knows the region, would describe the point Iran is at today.
Well, I think that you have a society whose various divisions that have been kind of trampled under by a rather authoritarian system are coming out, and people who used to not have conversations with each other, for example, Basiji militiamen who are hardline supporters of Ahmadinejad, and on the other side of that, you know, Sheikh kids from the north of Tehran who are more into redoing their noses than redoing their country, are having conversations with each other. and they're, you know, yelling at each other, but it's kind of jocular, and they're kind of getting to know each other. And maybe that's a very healthy thing in terms of the democratic development of the country.
You know, in the Middle East, Israel is often one of its claims to integrity in the region is it's the only democracy. I'm curious, are we seeing democracy in Iran?
I think that, you know, I take the view of political scientists that to have a real democracy, you need a middle class. And what has happened in the past 20, 30 years is that the middle class in Iran has really emerged and imposed its values and is thirsting for more power and recognition. And, you know, that's what makes a country like Israel or even Lebanon more democratic than the countries around it, because they don't have a middle class with a stake in the system and middle class values and education and civil society, things like that. And I think that's the change that's taking place in Iran, and that's unstoppable.
And a quick last question for you. When will we know the results?
Well, according to the regulations, the results have to be announced within 24 hours of the polls closing. Polls close tomorrow, 6 p.m. Tehran time, but they can be extended up to midnight. So it could be as late as Sunday.
All right. Thanks to all of our guests for joining the conversation today. Borzu Daragahi from the Los Angeles Times, Warren Strobel of the McClatchy Newspapers, Miriam Memarsadaghi, a Washington-based advisor to NGOs promoting human rights in the Middle East, Mohsen Milani, professor and chair of the Department of Government and International Affairs at the University of South Florida. We'll be right back with Which Way L.A.? I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. We're back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way L.A.? Governor Schwarzenegger has threatened to shut down state government if the legislature doesn't find a way to resolve California's budget crisis. Are lawmakers any closer to a budget deal? Democrats and Republicans are still far apart, but are divisions starting to show between the Senate and Assembly leaders? My guest today is Anthony York, editor of Capital Weekly, newspaper based in Sacramento. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
First, to clarify, Governor Schwarzenegger made those comments to an editorial board meeting at the Los Angeles Times. Of course, they reported on it. Was he looking for a political platform to make a point, or is he repeating this?
I don't think this is a very dramatic departure from what the governor has talked about all along. He's talked about the need for the legislature to act quickly because of the state's cash flow problem. The controller said if the legislature does nothing, the state will be $1 billion in the hole by the end of July. And that means that the state won't be able to pay some of its bills that are coming due. So I think the governor is sort of sketching out, you know, just reiterating and trying to stoke the legislature and keep the sense of urgency alive in getting a budget passed.
You know, it was kind of a strong statement he made, you know, that government would come to a grinding halt. I mean, what's it look like if government just puts the lights out?
It doesn't come to a grinding halt. The reality is, I mean, again, by the end of July, if there is no plan in place and if the federal government does not guarantee the low interest short term loans that the state used to get from private banks before the private banks started having such dire financial problems.
Yeah.
And that's really the reason for the urgency now. That's part of the reason, because those products are no longer available on the open market, so they need the federal government to guarantee those loans. But we've seen this happen in the past. When the state doesn't get a budget in place, they slowly and systematically begin defaulting on certain bills, issuing IOUs to state employees, and delaying other payments. And there's an actual hierarchy of the payments that need to be made. Education is first in line. Debt service, I believe, is second. But if nothing happens, if nothing is in place by July 1st, then there may be a period of some IOUs, but it's not like the state will come crashing down to a halt.
How's the legislature responding? Are they working hard on a budget?
Well, we saw the conference committee, which is there are 10 legislators, 5 from each house. They're working together and going item by item through the budget as we speak. They've been meeting for about the last 2 weeks. The first week was mostly public comment, and now they're systematically going through the line items of the budget. On Tuesday, we saw the Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg, sketch out his vision for what a plan would look like, essentially $13 billion in cuts, without getting too specific about what those cuts would be. But he did make clear that those cuts would not include the wholesale elimination of programs like CalWORKs, the Welfare to Work program, and Healthy Families, which provides health insurance for about 1 million low-income children in California. But Steinberg had a framework in mind, about $13 billion in cuts, adopting another $6 billion in fees and what they call revenue accelerators, and one of the great budget euphemisms that has become common in the budget vernacular up here. But those are proposals that have been put on the table by the governor. And then I think what got the most attention was drawing down the governor's proposed budget reserve. In the governor's budget, he has a rainy day fund or reserve of $4.5 billion. Steinberg said he would like to see that reduced to about $500 million. So reducing it by about $4 billion, that means $4 billion less in cuts.
And who's actually in control of that rainy day fund? Can the legislature, you know, do they give it and take it away, or is that under the governor's domain?
Well, the legislature has to spend any money, but it would be money that the state would have on hand that could be appropriated if there are shortfalls in revenues. And that's the other thing that's going on, and that's the governor's rationale for having that rainy day fund, is because since he made his proposal in May, the legislative analyst has come back with new revenue figures that show that the state is in worse shape than it was before. And the controller just yesterday, State Controller John Chung, came out and said that state revenues are continuing to fall. So, Steinberg is trying to characterize this as a rainy day fund. The governor is saying, "Hey, no, this is just the money we need to have on hand to fund the original budget that I put out in May, because the revenues keep getting worse and worse."
You've written about some of the differences between Senator Steinberg and Assembly Leader Karen Bass. They're both Democrats. Are there any issues there that could stall a budget resolution?
I think that slowing it down in terms, and what's a little unclear, and I sort of indicate this in the story, is how much of it is an ideological division and how much of it is just a difference in negotiating tactics. I mean, Steinberg was very specific about leading with cuts and starting with a firm number, $13 billion in cuts. Today we saw the Speaker, Karen Bass, talking about revenues and that we shouldn't just be talking about cuts. And I think that reflects a lot of the pushback that Bass is getting from members of her caucus. A lot of Assembly Democrats are saying, "Hey, wait a minute, why are we only talking about cuts? We've got to be talking about a mix of new revenues and cuts." And some of this is manifesting itself in the conference committee process that I alluded to earlier, mm-hmm. Where you see Senate Democrats and Republicans agreeing to cut certain programs and Assembly Democrats balking and refusing to go along with that. And so the item remains open and it's still unresolved. So there are some divisions that have emerged this week between the houses. I don't think that they're terribly uncommon, but they certainly do complicate the budget negotiations.
What are Republicans bringing to the table in terms of the conversation?
Well, they have been sort of in the background for now. They have held the line that they will not go along with new revenue increases. So Republican votes are necessary to enact these things quickly. The cuts, for example, could pass, but with simple majority votes. But with a two-thirds vote, they can go into effect quicker. So there would be more savings to the state. The Republicans have begun to push back on some cuts to corrections, laying off prison guards and the early release of some inmates. These are part of the governor's proposal, and we saw the Senate Republican leader Dennis Hollingsworth say that Republicans would not be in favor of those cuts. So again, it's another wrinkle. It's never just a deal between two people. It has to be kind of a five-sided deal, and I think we're getting closer to that, but we're still a ways off.
Last time around, the Democrats proposed a slew of fee increases that didn't depend on a two-thirds majority to pass.
Right.
Do you think there'll be more of that this time?
I do. I mean, I do think, you know, even if you look at Steinberg's numbers, he's talking about $13 billion in cuts. The governor had about $16 billion. He's talking about a reserve that's $4 billion smaller. So I do think that the cut number that the Democrats come up with will be in that neighborhood of $13 billion. But I do think that they will have some proposals for new revenues. And since that's a non-starter among Republicans, I think you're going to see a lot of fees and a lot of these sort of budget gimmicks that we've seen in the past, where you lower one tax – by the same amount that you're raising another, and then you replace another one with a fee so that you can do it with a 41-vote majority, a simple majority. I mean, these are the annual rounds of budget gymnastics that go on routinely that most people, you know, don't care about how it happens, but they're necessary for getting a deal passed, and I think we're going to see some of that again this year.
You know, Governor Schwarzenegger, you know, from the beginning, has talked about the fact that he was going to make Democrats and Republicans come together. There weren't going to be any more of these budget impasses. What's it say about him and his political muscle that we keep confronting these things?
I think that he'd be the first to admit that he's not been successful at his various efforts at reforming state government. I mean, you look up and down, you know, his list, what he was talking about from the very beginning, tearing up the state credit card or blowing up boxes, you know, all of the things that or a new spending cap on state spending. He's gone to the voters time and time again with these proposals, and they have not worked. Mm-hmm. Voters have not gone along with them, and I think that the governor would be the first to tell you that if there is a large failure of his administration thus far, his time in office, it's been the failure to fundamentally alter the way the California budget process works.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Anthony York is editor of Capital Weekly, a newspaper based in Sacramento. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Katie Cooper and Gary Scott. Our managing producer is Karen Radziner, and our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. I'm Sarah Terry. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.